Commandos are no match for the Iron Wolf Squadron and our CIDs. So what's his real plan? Vilk nodded. Even at Perun's Eyrie, where everything went wrong, it had taken an ambush by a battalion of Russian tanks and other armored fighting vehicles, together with massed artillery fire, to destroy the two Iron Wolf combat robots piloted by Charlie Turlock and Wack Makomer. And so far, they had no reports that would indicate Moscow was supplying Grislov's RKU mercenaries with tanks, self-propelled guns, or other heavy weapons.
The Russians could still hurt us badly in a sudden surprise attack, he pointed out. After all, there are only 6 CIDs in our order of battle. We cannot defend every vulnerable point in the Alliance of Free Nations.
Sure, Grislov's mercs could inflict some pain, Martindale said evenly, but not nearly enough to swing the outcome in a new war. He looked at Vilk. We just roll with the first punch and then tear them to shreds.
Perhaps friend Gennady is more optimistic about his chances against us than you are, the Polish president countered in a dry voice.
Oh, I'm sure he is, Martindale agreed. But he's still not crazy enough to see using hired Spetsnaz veterans as a winning play. Gaining a measure of plausible deniability for violent, covert action may be useful from a diplomatic and political point of view, but it doesn't change the fundamental military equation.
He may not define winning in quite the same way we do, Vilk warned. Russia's armed forces still outnumber ours. Moscow can trade pawn for pawn and still come out ahead. Maybe Grislov has decided to erode our strength with a series of pinprick raids using his mercenaries, confident that we will be unwilling to escalate in retaliation.
Martindale frowned. That was a nasty thought. A prolonged, covert war of attrition would not succeed in destroying Poland and its allies outright, but the military and economic strain involved in fending off a seemingly unending series of commando attacks and sabotage would be enormous. It was no secret that a number of governments in the Alliance of Free Nations were fragile, dependent on small paramilitary majorities and narrow margins of public support. If those governments fell, either by losing elections or because of massive public discontent, their successors might be more willing to cozy up to Moscow in return for peace. Having failed in his earlier all-out military and cyber war campaigns, was Grislov now willing to play a longer game? He shook his head. The willingness to fight a slow war of attrition seemed out of character for Russia's aggressive leader. On the other hand, it was a classic mistake to assume that an opponent could not learn from his earlier mistakes, which led directly to another piece of the puzzle that he could not make fit. Crazy or not, there was no way that Grislov could hope to skate away from responsibility for any attacks launched by Russian-made aircraft and missiles operating out of Russian-controlled air bases. So why was this RKU outfit recruiting veteran fighter and bomber pilots?
14. RKU Flight Operations Center, near Moab, Utah, the next day.
Yuri Anyenkov stood up to greet the two men who entered his sparsely furnished office at one end of the trailer. Despite their business suits, neither of them could really be mistaken for a mid-level corporate executive, no matter what it said on their false passports. While only of average height, both men were remarkably fit and moved with the easy assurance of men used to handling advanced aircraft under high G's in combat situations.
"How was your flight?" he asked.
"Uneventful from a security standpoint, but damned noisy."
Colonel Ruslan Barushev, the older of the two, answered. His thin-lipped smile stopped well short of his pale blue eyes.
"Some fat American woman's brat screamed all the way from Toronto to Salt Lake City."
Anyenkov winced in sympathy. No real pilot, especially not a former Su-50 stealth fighter squadron commander like Barushev, could enjoy being forced to travel as a mere passenger at the mercy of some other flyer. Doing so in the sort of dingy, jam-packed horror shows that passed for commercial airliners these days must have seemed like a foretaste of hell itself.
Barushev nodded toward his companion. "This is my wingman, Captain Oleg Imrikov." "Technically, I'm your former wingman, sir, and no longer exactly a captain,"
the younger man said with a more genuine smile. He sketched a salute to Anyenkov.
KVM senior pilot Imrikov reporting for duty.
Berushev shook his head in mock despair.
And thus you see how discipline dies in the glorious private sector, Yuri. Once I could have had this young whelp shot for disrespect. Now the best I can do is contemplate giving him a bad performance review.
Anyenkov laughed. He waved them into the two chairs in front of his desk and sat down himself.
The rest of your lads arrived yesterday, Ruslan. For now they're bunking with my air and ground crews. Any complaints?
Major Zalin did bitch a little about the selection of drinks at the old club, Anyenkov allowed. Berushev raised an eyebrow.
You have an officer's club here.
Only if you count a folding table with a bottle of vodka and a supply of disposable plastic cups as a club.
Ah, luxury, Imrikov said. Back at our old fighter base at Syktyvkar, we had to share our cups. And they were made out of paper, cheap paper. You were lucky to have that much, Oleg,
Berushev said with a grin.
In my days as a lowly junior pilot, we were only issued one drinking straw per regiment.
Dumping the grin, he turned back to Anyenkov.
How about our gear? Is everything in order? No problems, Anyenkov assured him. My ordnance man, Filipov, reports he'll have your Kibinitskaya Voyennye Mashina fully reassembled and battle-ready by tomorrow morning.
That's excellent news.
Satisfied, Berushev sat back.
Have we received the go orders and mission assignments from Moskva?
Anyenkov shook his head.
Not yet, but it can't be long now. Major General Kuraikin is pulling in all of our covert reconnaissance outfits. Once they get here, Captain Aristov's team will switch over to act as your local security element and ground transportation unit.
Berushev nodded his understanding.
I do have one question, Ruslan,
Anyenkov said carefully.
Why only employ six of these combat robots in your unit?
If Shahimat is so important to the higher-ups in Moskva, why not send a larger assault force?
Do you have any idea how much it costs to manufacture a KVM?
Berushev asked quietly.
Quite a bit, I would imagine. Perhaps the cost of a T-90 main battle tank? Or a little more?
Anyenkov guessed.
Try nearly 6 billion rubles, Yuri, Berushev said flatly.
Each. Anyenkov felt his eyes pop open wide in amazement.
6 billion rubles?
For a single robotic war machine?
My God,
he thought. That was around 100 million American dollars, which meant a KVM cost more than one of those fifth-generation Su-50 stealth fighters Berushev and his wingmen used to fly. Or 200 of the KH-35 cruise missiles arming his converted 737-200F cargo jet.
And they're worth how much? Without question,
the other man said. His pale eyes were infinitely colder now.
Only wait until my fighting machines go into action against the Americans. For years, their puppets and mercenaries have swaggered around the world, believing that no one else could ever develop this technology. Soon they will realize just how big a lie that was.
The Kremlin, Moscow, a short time later. For a long, uncomfortable moment, Gennady Gryzlov sat in silence, coolly observing the two men who'd just been ushered into his private office. As usual, Viktor Kazyanov, his long-suffering Minister of State Security, looked apprehensive. He was more a rabbit than a man, Gryzlov thought in contempt. Drops of sweat already beaded the intelligence director's high forehead. Vladimir Kuraikin, the head of RKU, was evidently made of stronger stuff. As befitted a decorated special forces commander with years of combat experience, he met the president's hard-eyed gaze without flinching. Gryzlov nodded politely to him, and then turned his attention back to Kazyanov.
So, Viktor, from that uncomfortable quiver in those fat white hands of yours, I assume your efforts to find and capture the foreign spies who infiltrated the 22nd Spetsnaz Brigade HQ have failed, he said,
as usual. The Minister of State Security swallowed convulsively.
I am afraid so, Mr. President,
he admitted with clear reluctance. He moistened his dry lips.
Without photographs or even decent descriptions of those who masqueraded as Colonel Zakharova and the accountant Solomon, our army and police units manning checkpoints on the highways and at airports and rail stations had too little to go on.
So the criminals who murdered two of our soldiers and stole vital secrets have successfully escaped?
Gryzlov asked. He forced himself to speak calmly, almost as though he were asking the spy chief about the weather outside. Miserably, Kazyanov nodded.
And which of the various foreign intelligence services do your analysts believe committed this outrage?
Without more evidence, that is a difficult question to answer,
Kazyanov said carefully.
Ballistics analysis indicates that the weapon used to kill Captain Leonov and Sergeant Izayev was originally used to kill an FSB assassination squad that disappeared without a trace in Thailand more than 10 years ago. And unfortunately, nothing else we've found so far concretely ties this operation to any particular enemy country.
And yet, your analysts are paid to answer difficult questions, are they not?
Gryzlov asked with deceptive mildness.
Yes, Mr. President.
Kazyanov agreed hurriedly. He hesitated for a second or two and then went on.
Well, the consensus seems to be that it might have been the CIA.
Bullshit!
Gryzlov snapped.
Are you really that stupid, Victor? Do you genuinely believe the CIA would try something so audacious, or authorize its agents to kill so mercilessly?
He shook his head in disgust.
Haven't you been paying attention to our own damned reports? The dickless cretins Barbeau put in charge of the CIA are far more interested in handing out rainbow-colored condoms at Langley gay rights celebrations than in conducting high-risk operations like this one.
He stared coldly at Kazyanov, savoring the sudden rush of power as the bigger man physically wilted into his chair.
No, this was Martindale's doing. He's the only one out there ruthless enough to order this kind of wet work on our soil.
Kraikin spoke up.
That would certainly explain those brief radar contacts made by the S-400 battalion at Feodosia.
Precisely, Gryzlov said. It was one of Martindale's damned stealth aircraft, probably the same as the old transport he used at Perun's Eri. And it slipped through our whole air defense network without anyone laying a finger on it.
His eyes were hooded.
I am getting very tired of watching our vaunted defenders of the motherland screw up time and time again.
The corners of his mouth turned down.
Perhaps our radar crews, SAM units, and fighter pilots need another taste of the lash.
Neither Kazyanov and Kraikin said anything to dispute him.
And they are wise not to,
Gryzlov thought icily. Thanks to hacked acquisition and targeting software installed in Russia's most advanced SAM regiments, some of Martindale's Iron Wolf mercenaries had escaped his carefully laid trap at Perun's Eri cyberwar complex. And unable to trust his own weapons, he'd been forced to concede a draw to the American and Polish paymaster, Piotr Wilk. Furious, he'd made sure that heads rolled.
The first of those to fall had been Colonel General Maximov, once his own mentor at the Yuri Gagarin Military Academy.
Maximov had been forced to resign as head of the Aerospace Defense Force for medical reasons. When the general suffered a fatal stroke a few months later, Moscow's gossips had darkly whispered the old man's death wasn't natural. Gryzlov considered it revealing that so many of his countrymen were willing to blame poison for a seizure actually triggered by deep personal shame and public humiliation. On the other hand, there'd been nothing natural about the sudden deaths of more than a dozen top software engineers in Nizhny Novgorod. Unless, of course, you understood that taking a bullet in the back of the head was the natural and inevitable consequence of treason and incompetence. For a few seconds, he pondered ordering another round of court-martial and executions, starting with the lazy buffoons at the 22nd Guard Spetsnaz Brigade and eventually moving on to the blind, deaf, and dumb Su-27 fighter pilots who'd failed to intercept Martindale's stealth aircraft.
Not yet, he decided. None of those he might punish were going anywhere. Let them sweat. His decision made, Gryzlov looked up from his brief reverie with a scowl. Kazyanov, who'd been caught mopping at his brow with a handkerchief, froze. His face turned gray with fear.
Get out, Victor, Gryzlov said with a heavy sigh. Verbally abusing the other man was still mildly amusing, but the experience was beginning to pall. Sooner or later he was going to have to get rid of Kazyanov.
And the Minister of State Security knew only too well that men in his position, with access to so many secrets, rarely lived long enough to enjoy retirement. Gryzlov made a mental note to have Kazyanov put under even closer surveillance. It would never do for poor old Victor to imagine he could successfully defect. When the door closed behind Kazyanov, Gryzlov turned back to Kurykin.
How badly has our security been compromised?
He asked bluntly.
I've reviewed the files those two spies accessed, Kurykin said. Whoever did this must now be aware of RKU's existence, and at least some of our capabilities. He shrugged.
If there were any doubt, cyber specialists from the FSB's Q Directorate detected in-depth probes of different commercial and government databases within 24 hours after the incident at Bataysk. But they were unable to trace those probes back to any identifiable source.
Which really tells us all we need to know about who was responsible, Gryzlov said dryly. Martindale's Scion operatives were poking around for more information about RKU.
Yes, Mr. President, Kurykin nodded.
He hesitated, knowing how little Russia's leader liked hearing unwelcome suggestions.
It might be best to delay implementing Shahimat until we can build in more layers of operational secrecy. If Martindale or the Poles pass their information on to the Americans,
checkmate will proceed on schedule, Gryzlov said, cutting him off with a sharp defensive rap on his desk. Whatever personnel files and equipment records were stolen from Bataysk could not have compromised our operational plans. Meanwhile, your forces are already in position. Delay now would only increase the risk of the Americans stumbling across some of our people by accident.
Again Kurykin nodded. There was truth in the president's blunt assertion. While internal security in the United States was so lax as to be almost non-existent, there was always the chance of one of his teams being caught in a routine traffic stop gone wrong, or in some other slip-up.
Besides, Vladimir, Gryzlov continued with a smile, the fact that Martindale knows he has a new Russian competitor is essentially meaningless. Even if he somehow persuades Barbeau and others that he's telling the truth, what can they do?
He leaned back in his chair.
That is the beauty of our plan, is it not? We are co-opting the same tactic of plausible deniability so often used by the Americans to evade responsibility for Soyuz's own actions.
Privately, Kurykin suspected almost no one would swallow Gryzlov's claims of innocence once the Americans figured out what was really going on. Though he supposed that a few neutrals and a handful of the weaker Western Allied powers might be willing to choose a convenient lie over the inconvenient truth. But no major world player would buy the idea of a freelance rogue Russian military corporation operating outside Moscow's command and control. Still, he concluded, handling the inevitable diplomatic and military fallout from this operation would be a problem for the president to solve later. His particular and immediate task was simpler. His job was to make sure the RKU's attacks were structured to cause maximum confusion and to inflict as much damage as possible in a short period of time. The more confusion, the longer it would take the U.S. to pin this operation on Moscow. And the more damage his forces caused, the more difficult it would be for the Americans to retaliate effectively against the motherland. Kurykin came back to the present moment. Wisely or unwisely, President Gryzlov had made his decision. Operatsiya Shahimat would proceed. Julius Caesar's comment on crossing the Rubicon, declaring war against Pompey and the Roman Senate, came to mind.
Elia iacta est. The die is cast.
So now, as a loyal soldier, he must do his best to make sure that die landed with the winning number face up.
Yes, Mr. President, he said simply.
Good. I'm glad that's settled,
Grislov said, sounding satisfied.
So now we can move on to the details. First, have your staff planners finally settled on a first target? Or are they still pissing around with their maps and briefing books?
With an effort, Kurykin suppressed a quick flash of irritation. Selecting the most vulnerable and valuable targets from the wealth of information gathered by his covert recon groups was no easy matter in the first place. But it was child's play compared with the work required to develop coordinated movement and assault plans that made the most effective use of RKU's war robots, enabling them to arrive in striking distance in secret and then to escape undetected.
We do have a recommendation, Mr. President, he said finally. We propose launching Checkmate's first blow to cause maximum damage to our country's most dangerous enemy.
Show me.
Kurykin pulled out his laptop and connected it to Grislov's ultra-secure private network. Completely independent of any Kremlin servers connected to the outside world, this network was designed to be almost impossible for hackers to penetrate. Only the president's most trusted subordinates were granted access or allowed to connect their own devices. Periodic sweeps of Q Directorate specialists checked for any signs of infiltration or hidden malware. A map of the western United States appeared on the large LED screen set into Grislov's desk. Kurykin tapped a key on his laptop. The map zoomed in, revealing a stretch of high desert in northern Nevada, nestled in among several mountain ranges. A target icon blinked into existence on top of what looked like an airfield.
As you can see, there are only a few highways we can use to move our KVMs into range of this objective. But that same relative isolation ensures a significant delay before regular American military forces can react to our assault. By conducting simultaneous cruise missile strikes at key choke points, we can further...
Permission denied,
Grislov said quietly. Startled, Kurykin looked away from the projected map.
Excuse me, Mr. President.
I know you're not deaf, Major General, the President said. You heard me perfectly. This proposed target is off the table, at least for now.
But why?
Because, Grislov said patiently, if we play our cards right, the Americans themselves will take care of those troublemakers. We won't even have to lift a finger or fire a single missile.
For a moment, just a moment, Kurykin saw red. What the hell kind of manipulative game was the President playing with him? Only years of ingrained discipline prevented him from throwing a punch right into the younger man's smug face, that and the certainty that doing so would mean a painful and lingering death. Gennady Grislov was not a forgiving man. With difficulty, he regained a small measure of control over his emotions.
I see,
he said through gritted teeth.
Does this mean you've already chosen another target of your own, sir?
That's correct.
Grislov agreed. He held up a hand in apology.
I'm sorry to have sprung this on you so suddenly, Vladimir, but we're being handed a golden opportunity, one we would be fools to ignore.
He tapped the slick surface of the computer built into his desk. Instantly, Kurykin's operational map disappeared. In its place, short clips from several recent American television news programs scrolled across the screen, accompanied by titles in Russian. When they ended, another map appeared, this one centered on the southeastern United States. A single red targeting icon blossomed on the map.
There's your new first objective, Grislov said.
He smiled, seeing Kurykin's face suddenly pale. Devilish amusement danced in his eyes.
The Americans are busy making themselves look like idiots with this interminable political season of theirs. So why shouldn't we help make sure their presidential election campaign starts off with a bang, eh?
15. Air Force One, Barksdale Air Force Base, Louisiana. Several days later. We're on final approach to Barksdale, Madam President, one of Stacy Ann Barbeau's uniformed military aides reported. With a big, friendly smile, she looked up.
Why, thank you, Tommy. I appreciate the heads up.
I must have been lost in my reading.
Ostentatiously, she closed the thick briefing book she'd been pretending to study since flying out of Andrews Air Force Base outside Washington, D.C. more than 2 hours ago. Why the Pentagon brass thought she could possibly be interested in an assembly of boring background papers about the different units stationed at Barksdale was a mystery. Irritating though it was, there were certain niceties to be observed in her sometimes tense relationship with the U.S. military. Despite the big-ticket weapons projects and pay increases she'd rammed through Congress, too many officers and enlisted personnel disliked her admiration, and were hoping that Farrell would beat her in November. The big 747-8, designed as a VC-25B in its military configuration, vibrated slightly as its landing gear came down and locked. Barbeau leaned over in her luxurious big leather seat to look out the armored window. They were coming in low over the lush green woods and bayous of northwestern Louisiana. Off to the west, she could see the muddy brown waters of the Red River snaking back and forth between Shreveport and Bossier City. Luke Cohen poked his head in through the open door to her onboard office. "We're all set. The press plane landed an hour ago, and our advanced team has the good little boys and girls of the media safely corralled in a roped-off area. They've got great camera angles for your arrival, review of the troops, and speech. But they're set up just a little too far away for any awkward candid interviews with people on the base." "Are any of them bitching about that?" Her White House chief of staff shrugged. "A couple." He gave her a sly grin. "But our guys blamed it on the Air Force. The imperatives of national security, you know?" "Nice job," Barbeau said, pleased. The fact that Barksdale itself was close to civilians was one of the pluses in what her staff was billing as an official inspection of renewed American air power by the nation's commander-in-chief. The press could either parrot back the story she handed them on a platter, or nothing. "How's the weather shaping up?" "It's hot and muggy as hell," Cohen said. "But the most recent forecast says it won't rain until much later, long after we're gone." She nodded. Louisiana was her home state, and oppressive temperatures and humidity were typical for this time of year. Fortunately, the same Botox injections that smoothed out her wrinkles and made her look years younger than her real age also kept her from sweating. That must be one more secret weapon in her political arsenal. While everyone around her looked about ready to melt, she would come across as cool, clean, and perfectly composed. Air Force One touched down with barely a jolt and decelerated in a roar of reversed engines and brakes, slowing fast as it rolled down the airbase's newly 12,000-foot-long runway. Cohen gripped the edge of the doorframe and rode easily with the motion. Barbeau turned back to the window. Outside, she could see thousands of airmen and officers lined up at parade rest in neat ranks. Their blue dress uniforms made a nice contrast with the reddish-brown earth tones of the wide concrete apron. 24 multi-role stealth fighters of the U.S. Air Force's first operational F-35 Lightning II squadron were parked behind them. Next to the fighters were a half-dozen mammoth dark gray B-52H Stratofortress strategic bombers, along with two swept-wing XB-1F Excaliburs. She hit a frown. Those two Excaliburs, and the others deployed elsewhere, were old B-1B Lancers originally upgraded by Skymasters as part of one of Patrick McClanahan's nutty private military schemes. Sure, she'd had the Air Force seize the XB-1F bombers for its own use as soon as she took office. Nevertheless, seeing them here was an unwelcome reminder that the U.S. Armed Forces were still too dependent on weapons and aircraft authorized by her old political rivals. For nearly 4 years, Barbeau's administration had blocked Skymasters from landing new Pentagon contracts, but the company limped along anyway, surviving on sales to the domestic market, foreign countries, and Martindale's Scion mercenaries. She gritted her teeth. It was high time that she shoved Skymasters and its backers into the dustbin of aviation history. And with luck, today's big show would help make that happen by unveiling America's newest and most advanced long-range stealth bomber. "Where's our B-21 Raider prototype?" she asked, still watching out the window. There, at the far end of the apron, she saw a light gray C-17 Globemaster III transport waiting off to the side.
That plane had flown in ahead of Air Force One, ferrying the black SUVs and limousines that made up her presidential motorcade. There were no plans for her to drive anywhere on this trip, but the Secret Service always insisted on covering all possible bases.
"Orbiting a few miles away, out of sight," Cohen told her. "I confirmed that with our liaison to the contractor a couple of minutes ago.
And the flight crews know what to do."
The New Yorker nodded.
"As soon as we're parked and the Secret Service has cleared you to deplane, they'll start their approach. Everything's timed so that the shiny new B-21 Raider will touch down just as you're being greeted by the base commander and his staff."
He winked at her.
"Those pictures are going to lead every newscast tonight, Madam President. They'll be on the front page of every newspaper tomorrow morning. Hell, they'll go viral on the internet as soon as we upload them to the White House website and reporters post their own pics on social media."
Stacey Ann Barbeau smiled broadly. This taxpayer-funded kickoff for her presidential re-election campaign would be a day to remember. Inside the base perimeter, that same time. Accompanied by the soft whine of servos and actuators, a sleek, deadly-looking gray machine stalked through the woods and bayous east of Barksdale's runway. Shadows cast by magnolias, oak trees, and tall slash pines float across its elongated torso, eyeless spherical head, and thin, agile arms and legs. Despite the bulky weapons packs strapped to it, the robot moved with remarkable speed and stealth. Quietly, it came to a place where the trees grew closer together. Ahead, the ground sloped down very slightly into a tangle of ferns and thickets of switch cane. Knobby, thick-trunked bald cypresses rose out of a ribbon of stagnant, tea-colored water. Suddenly, the robot stopped moving. It crouched lower, nestling down among the undergrowth. Its antenna-studded head swiveled rapidly from side to side. Inside the cockpit, KVM senior pilot Oleg Imrikov studied his displays. He was picking up a bright green thermal signature, man-sized and man-shaped, a little over 100 meters ahead, on the other side of this narrow stretch of bayou. Using a low-light visual sensor slaved into his robot's thermal imager, he zoomed in on the same spot. He saw a young American soldier in camouflage fatigues standing next to a tall four-wheeled all-terrain vehicle. Through a pair of binoculars, the soldier was peering up at a bird's nest in the branches of a tall pine tree farther down the bayou. By the twin stripes on his sleeve, he was an airman first class, and a patch unit identified him as a member of the 2nd Security Forces Squadron. Apart from a holstered 9mm pistol, the American was unarmed. Imrikov opened a secure radio link.
"Whatever then your lead, this is two."
Colonel Barushev replied immediately. His own combat robot was moving through the woods about 500 meters north of this position.
"Spectre lead to Spectre 2. Go ahead. I've encountered an American airman to my front. He hasn't seen me yet, but there is no way I can go around him without being spotted." "Is this man a sentry or a scout?"
Barushev asked, sounding concerned, and rightly so. Nothing in Kirill Aristov's reconnaissance reports had suggested they might run into enemy resistance along this concealed line of approach. If the Americans had scouts or observation posts deployed this far out from the runway, their assault could be easily compromised. It was essential that all six Russian KVMs reach the target without being detected.
"Neither,"
Imrikov said.
"The American seems to be birdwatching. He may be one of their game wardens."
He heard the colonel bite down on a curse. Barksdale Air Force Base sprawled over more than 22,000 acres. Some of that land was set aside as protected nature preserves. Monitoring the endangered plant and animal species on this huge base was the job of a very small force of airmen assigned as game wardens. And that made this sudden unexpected meeting sheer bad luck.
"Can you silence the American before he raises an alarm?"
"I think so,"
Imrikov replied calmly.
"Then do it."
Obeying the commands he relayed through his neural link, Imrikov's KVM leaped to its feet and charged forward into the bayou, accelerating up with every long-legged stride. Stagnant, foul-smelling water splashed high across the robot's spindly legs. Startled by the sudden explosion of noise, the young American airman spun toward the bayou, He dropped his binoculars, fumbling for the pistol holstered at his side. His eyes widened.
What the hell?
Imrikov's machine burst out of the swamp in a spray of mud and torn vegetation. Before the airman could get a firm grip on his Beretta M9 pistol, the Russian KVM pilot leaned forward and batted him aside with one of the robot's large metal hands. With a muffled cry, the American went tumbling head over heels in a spray of blood and broken bone. He landed face down in a clump of ferns and collapsed in an unmoving heap, clearly dead.
Situation resolved satisfactorily. Inspector radioed. Spectre 2 is proceeding to target at best possible speed.
Over southern Arkansas. That same time. Reagan Air Freight Flight 175 flew southeast at 25,000 feet, through blue skies marked by wisps of high, thin white cloud. According to its flight manifest, the 737-200F cargo jet was ferrying wind turbine components from Indianapolis to Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport. But instead of turbine blades and nacelles, 16 KH-35 UE cruise missiles filled its cargo compartment, waiting silently on four track-mounted rotary launchers.
Reagan 175, Memphis Center, an air traffic controller said in Yuri Anyenkov's headset. Contact Fort Worth Center on 134.475. Have a good day.
They were leaving the airspace supervised by the FAA's Memphis Air Traffic Control Center and entering that monitored by its Fort Worth counterpart. Anyenkov clicked his mic.
134.475 for Reagan 175. Thank you, Memphis.
He waited while his co-pilot, Major Konstantin Uspensky, changed radio frequencies as directed. Then he keyed his mic again.
Fort Worth Center, Reagan 175, level 250.
The voice of a new controller responded immediately, acknowledging that they were in his area of responsibility and that he had them on his radar screen.
Reagan 175, roger.
And Yenkov made sure he wasn't broadcasting over the radio and glanced at Uspensky.
Give me a position check.
His co-pilot toggled one of the multifunction cockpit displays added when this old Boeing air freighter was secretly converted into a cruise missile carrier. A map appeared showing their current position and projected course. A red dot pulsed rhythmically about 20 nautical miles ahead.
We are coming up on our pre-planned launch coordinates, Colonel, he confirmed. 3 minutes out.
Then let's run through the attack checklist,
Anyenkov said, summoning up his own digital copy with a quick tap. He read off the first item.
Confirm power to rotary launcher handling system.
The handling system is live,
Uspensky said, checking to make sure electrical power was flowing to the array of high-speed pulleys and hoists that would haul their rotary launchers along the rails built into the cargo deck floor.
Bring launchers online.
The co-pilot tapped controls on his MFD. Four lights on a schematic of the cargo compartment turned green.
Our rotary launchers are online and linked to the attack computer. Transfer our GPS coordinates to the computer and initialize missile inertial guidance systems.
Uspensky obeyed, efficiently keying in the commands that fed their precisely calculated current position to the inertial navigation systems that would control the KH-35s in flight. More green lights blossomed on his displays. This was a workaround to help reduce the small position errors inevitably accumulated by inertial systems during flight. More modern KH-35 missiles included GLO-NASS receivers, which enabled them to obtain highly accurate satellite navigation data from Russia's equivalent of the U.S. Global Positioning System. But using those advanced missile variants would have made it easier to pin this attack on Moscow itself, rather than on someone else using KH-35s covertly purchased on the international arms black market.
Guidance systems initialized.
Confirm pre-selected target sets are downloaded to the missiles,
Anyenkov ordered.
All target sets are downloaded. Bring the missiles to full readiness.
Uspensky tapped more virtual controls on his display. He watched closely as data scrolled across the screen in response.
Radar altimeters are good. Turbofans are good. Self-destruct systems are good. He looked up. All missiles are flight ready, Colonel.
Checklist complete,
Anyenkov said in satisfaction.
Time to launch position.
30 seconds.
Anyenkov tightened his shoulder straps and donned an oxygen mask. Beside him, Uspensky did the same. He reached up to the overhead instrument panel and set the 737's pressurization control system to manual. He flipped two switches on the same panel.
Depressurizing the cargo deck.
The engine bleed valves feeding pressurized air to the jet's cargo deck closed tight. At the same time, outflow valves opened on the fuselage. Pressure on the cargo deck dropped fast, rapidly equalizing with that of the much thinner atmosphere at 25,000 feet.
15 seconds,
Uspensky reported, watching their current position indicator close on the launch coordinates RKU's planners had selected for this mission. Carefully but quickly, Anyenkov entered another command on his MFD, temporarily transferring control of the aircraft to their attack computer. He put his hands back on the yoke, but kept them relaxed.
5 seconds.
At a precisely computed moment, the 737's enlarged forward cargo door unlatched and slid back along its fuselage. The twin engine jet shuddered, rocked by increased turbulence.
Commencing attack,
Uspensky said tersely. Smoothly, their first rotary launcher whirred into position at the open cargo door and started spinning, ejecting sky-gray cruise missiles out into the slipstream. As soon as all four of its missiles were away, the now empty launcher swung toward the rear of the aircraft, replaced almost immediately with the next in line. One by one, the 16 KH-35s dropped toward the distant Earth. Their turbofan motors would not ignite until they reached their operational attack altitude, just 10 to 15 meters above the ground. No one saw them falling away from the 737. Between their camouflage paint and relatively small size, the missiles were effectively invisible to other aircraft in the area, all of which were separated laterally by at least 5 nautical miles and vertically by 2,000 feet. The KH-35s were also too small to show up on the civilian air traffic control radars monitoring this sector.
Launch complete,
Uspensky reported from his side of the cockpit.
No ordnance remaining.
The 737's forward cargo door slid shut and sealed. With Anyenkov back at the controls, Reagan Air Freight Flight 175 continued on its submitted flight plan toward Dallas-Fort Worth. To all outward appearances, it was again just one of the thousands of commercial jets operating in U.S. airspace. Interstate 20, near Houghton, Louisiana. Several minutes later, Louisiana State Police Sergeant Damon Benoit swung down out of his official Chevrolet Tahoe and started walking up the shoulder of Interstate 20 toward the blue Honda Odyssey minivan he'd just pulled over for speeding. The Honda had Texas plates.
How wonderful, he thought sarcastically. Yet another family from the Dallas or Fort Worth suburbs heading off on vacation, and too rushed to obey traffic laws for their neighboring state. He sighed, already imagining the harassed-looking driver's embarrassed apologies and pleas for mercy.
Suddenly, a finned gray cylinder blurred overhead with an ear-splitting howl. It was flying so low that it barely cleared the tops of the trees lining both sides of the divided highway. Startled, Benoit dove for the ground, instinctively clawing for the Glock 22 pistol at his side. His campaign hat flew off, blew into the road, and disappeared under the wheels of an eastbound Toyota Camry. More missiles slashed through the sky in rapid succession, all heading southwest. Along the highway, shocked drivers gawked up through their windshields at the shapes streaking through the air just above them, and then just as abruptly slammed on their brakes, frantically swerving to avoid colliding with other cars and trucks. Tires squealed and horns blared in all directions. Swearing out loud, Benoit scrambled to his feet, turned and sprinted back toward his patrol SUV and its radio. 16. Barksdale Air Force Base, Louisiana. That same time.
And so, my fellow Americans, this nation will stay the course of peace through strength and common sense. While I am president, we will never entangle ourselves in petty overseas squabbles that are none of our business. But at the same time, America will be powerful enough to deter any aggression against our vital national interests. That is why I am committed to rebuilding our neglected military, especially the Air Force I've loved and admired all my life. And as new and ever more advanced aircraft, like our spectacular F-35 Lightning II stealth fighters and the incredible B-21 Raider parked behind me, roll off our production lines in growing numbers, the whole world will see that I mean business. President Stacy Ann Barbeau promised in a clear, determined voice. She paused, allowing the huge crowd of U.S. Air Force personnel ranked below her dais to clap for a few seconds. Behind the broad smile she displayed for the TV cameras focused on her, she kept a firm hold on a growing feeling of irritation. Despite the guaranteed applause lines her White House speechwriters had sprinkled throughout this address, rousing genuine fervor from this bunch was proving almost impossible. She wasn't drawing the wild whoops and cheers she'd expected. They were polite, but not enthusiastic. Her only consolation was that most of the media would focus its reporting on the good stuff. "Today is all about the visuals, Stacy," she reminded herself. "All about the images of shiny new warplanes, flags fluttering, gorgeously uniformed bands playing, with her front and center as the nation's tough plane spokesperson commander-in-chief." Before the tepid applause could fade into embarrassing silence, Barbeau made a big show of shushing the crowd. "Thank you. Thank you so much," she said with grace and tremendous warmth. Sincerity was one of the first things she'd learned to fake when she'd picked out politics as her path to the top. "And so together, we're going to..." And then a missile screamed in low across the runway, ripping past the crowded dais at more than 500 knots. It slammed straight into the base of the 20-story tall control tower and exploded. A burst of searing white light flared for a millisecond, followed by a roiling cloud of orange and red flame. For what seemed like an eternity but couldn't really have been much more than a second, Barbeau stood frozen, rooted to her podium in utter disbelief. Then one of her Secret Service agents hurtled across the dais. He knocked her flat and covered her with his body. "Stay down! Stay down!" he screamed. More missiles shrieked past, veering off to strike different targets. One after another, Barksdale's communications center, hangars, machine shops, and fuel storage areas went up in towering columns of smoke, flame, and falling debris. The ground rocked. As the missiles detonated, the noise was so loud that each separate blast struck with the force of a physical blow. Across the wide concrete apron, airmen and reporters and White House staffers scattered frantically in all directions, seeking cover. With their weapons out and aimed in all directions, Secret Service agents formed a human phalanx around Barbeau as she lay prone. Still winded and gasping for air, Special Agent in Charge Rafael Diaz leaned over and yelled loud enough for her to hear over the high-pitched howl of incoming missiles and deafening, bone-rattling explosions.
"We're getting you out of here, Madam President, right now!"
Without waiting for a reply, Diaz whirled around to his nearby agents.
"Get the beast moving! Let's go! Let's go!"
Painfully, Barbeau turned her head, blearily peering through the crouched huddle of agents who were shielding her from flying fragments and falling debris. Just a few yards away, her big black 15,000-pound limousine named the Beast started rolling forward from its assigned station. Agents leaped off the dais and yanked the car's rear door open using coded taps on hidden sensor panels. With their sole priority being to remove the president from immediate danger as quickly as possible, two agents unceremoniously grabbed her by the arms and hustled her bodily toward the moving car. Without pausing, they pushed her through the open door and onto the limo's plush rear seat. One agent leaped in behind her as the other agent slammed the solid 8-inch-thick door shut. Then, with all four tires squealing across the pavement, the Beast took off. Its powerful V8 turbo engine labored under tons of armor plating, bulletproof glass, communications gear,
and defensive systems. As it accelerated, the limousine barreled straight through a mob of panic-stricken journalists and camera crews scrambling to get out of its way. Muffled thumps and screams showed that not all of them succeeded. The Secret Service agent who'd piled in before the door was shut squirmed around on the seat and stared back through the rear window.
"Jesus Christ!" he exclaimed. "What the hell are those things?"
"Spectre lead to all Spectre units," Colonel Ruslan Barushev radioed from inside the cockpit of his KVM.
"Attack! Repeat, attack!"
Gleeful acknowledgements poured through his headset, but he was already in motion, sending his war robot lunging out of the forest lining the east side of Barksdale's long runway. His battle computer silhouetted the 24 American F-35 stealth fighters lined up wingtip to wingtip on the apron, identifying them as primary targets. They were more than 1,000 meters away. Closing the distance at more than 70 miles an hour, Barushev aimed his 30-millimeter autocannon and opened fire on the run. Multiple armor-piercing high-explosive rounds hammered the distant fighters. Hit repeatedly, the F-35s disappeared behind a rippling curtain of smoke and fire. Jagged fragments of wings, canopies, and fuselages cartwheeled away out of the smoke. American airmen caught in the path of the bullets vaporized, blown apart into bits of flesh and shattered bone. The other KVMs were shooting too, pounding the XB-1F Excaliburs and the just-landed B-21 Raider prototype with their own autocannons and the Israeli-made Spike anti-tank missiles. Plane after plane down the flight line exploded.
"This is a turkey shoot!"
Imrikov yelled exultantly over their secure link.
"We've caught the Americans with their pants down! They cannot touch us!"
With a harsh laugh, Barushev shifted his aim, zeroing in on one of the mammoth B-52H bombers parked next to the fighters. Bigger than the single-engine multi-role F-35s, the Stratofortress absorbed several direct hits before slewing sideways, wrecked and cloaked in dancing orange flames and oily black smoke. Panting, Barbo hauled herself upright in the limo's rear seat as it raced away at 60 miles an hour. She turned to look back at the nightmarish scene behind them. Her bruised ribs sent pain sleeting through her brain like white-hot stiletto-sharp needles. For a moment, she thought she should vomit. Then her vision cleared. There, out of the thick billowing clouds of smoke, several tall, spindly metal shapes appeared, moving with eerie precision and terrifying grace. The weapons they carried spat fire and death, slaughtering everyone in their path and destroying stationary aircraft with contemptuous ease. Barbo's eyes widened in horror. She knew only too well what those creatures were. An anti-tank missile launched by one of those robots streaked across the path of the speeding limousine. Trailing smoke and fire, it slammed into the fuselage of Air Force One and exploded.
"Pop smoke! Pop smoke!"
the Secret Service agent next to her screamed into the intercom.
Whoomp, whoomp, whoomp.
3 multi-spectrum infrared smoke grenades triggered by the driver exploded around the beast. In a fraction of a second, billowing white clouds blotted out Barbeau's view of the 2-legged war machines that were systematically destroying Barksdale Air Force Base. Terrified almost out of her wits and desperately trying to tell herself that what she'd seen with her own eyes could not possibly be real, she sat frozen, staring back into the swirling veil of protective smoke as her limousine sped away for safety. Through his neural link, Imrikov felt several rifle-caliber rounds smack into his KVM's rear composite armor. They ricocheted off.
"No damage," his computer reported. "Hostiles at 6 o'clock.
Irked, he whirled through a half-circle. There, half-hidden by the blazing wreckage of the American President's 747 jetliner, his sensors showed several airmen lying prone on the pavement. They were shooting at him with M4 carbines and pistols.
"That is brave, but very foolish," he thought. "And it will be fatal."
Grinning cruelly, Imrikov raised his 30-millimeter autocannon. It fired once, and then fell silent.
"Cannon ammunition expended," the KVM told him.
He'd used up all of his rounds, destroying the enemy fighters and bombers they'd caught on the ground.
"Thermo,"
he growled.
"Shit."
So be it. He would handle this the old-fashioned way. Imbrikov sprinted toward the enemy soldiers who were shooting at him. More 5.56-millimeter rounds spanged off his robot's armor. He ignored the hits and ran on, closing fast. At the last moment, the tiny group of Americans scrambled to their feet and tried to fall back, but it was too late. His KVM burst into their midst and blurred into lethal motion. Lashing out with its robotic hands and feet, Airman went flying in every direction, felled by powerful blows that crushed rib cages and shattered skulls. Exhilarated by the ease with which he'd slaughtered his enemies, Imrikov crouched down among their mangled corpses, employing his massive and active sensors to scan for more targets to kill. To his intense annoyance, he could not find any. The American airbase was a sea of devastation. Buildings hit by KH-35 warheads were smoldering heaps of broken concrete and twisted steel. Curtains of fire rippled high above destroyed fuel storage tanks. Wrecked aircraft and torn corpses littered the field. Berushev's exultant voice broke into his thoughts.
Spectre lead to all Spectre units. Mission complete. Disengage and withdraw to the rally point.
Brought back to the present, Imrikov replied, Two copies lead, disengaging. He brought the KVM back to its feet and moved across the runway, joining the other RKU war machines as they broke off and headed for the woods. Captain Paul Fraser skidded around the corner of a burning, bomb-ravaged building. Scorching waves of heat washed over him. Gasping, the Air Force captain raced on and broke out into the open. There, across the pad, he saw his HH-60G Pathhawk search and rescue helicopter. His co-pilot, Seth Hahn, had already had the bird spooling up. His crew had been on standby in case anything went wrong during the president's visit. Responding to a massive surprise missile and ground attack hadn't been very high up on their briefed list of possible missions. But as far as Fraser could see, his Pathhawk was the only flyable aircraft left at Barksdale, which made it imperative that they get it in the air and at least try to track the bastards who'd nailed the base. He pulled himself up into the cockpit and dropped into his seat. Hahn tossed him a headset and plugged in.
All set?
We're set, his co-pilot assured him. The engines and flight controls look solid.
Gunners, ready!
The two crewmen in the back reported. They were already manning the HH-60G's two 7.62 miniguns. Rapidly, Fraser ran through an extremely abbreviated takeoff checklist. The moment he finished, he throttled up to full power and took them into the air, climbing as fast as possible. They needed to break clear of the smoke and turbulence created by fires burning everywhere across the base. A minute later, the Pathhawk clattered over Barksdale's runway, heading east at 60 knots. Sitting in the left-hand seat, Hahn peered down at the display he'd set to show images captured by their nose-mounted forward-looking infrared camera.
Contact with multiple thermal sources, some sort of legged machines, big suckers. Maybe twice human-sized, maybe more. They're moving east through the woods and bayous about 5 clicks ahead.
Speed? Fraser asked.
Damn fast,
his co-pilot said, sounding surprised. Whatever those things are, they're clocking up to 40 miles an hour. And that's cross-country. None of them are using the roads or trails in this part of the reservation.
You're shitting me,
Fraser said. He looked ahead through the windscreen. All he could see was a solid green canopy of trees and more trees. What kind of machines could move so fast right through the heart of that swampy, overgrown forest? And where the hell were they headed?
Enemy helicopter closing fast, Colonel Berushev's computer reported.
He frowned, seeing the icon appear on his display. It was unfortunate that the Americans had been able to react so rapidly. This deep in the forest, his robot's weapons would be of little use against an airborne target. He needed to find a better position. Through his neural link, the KVM highlighted a small clearing not far away. It was the site of a mothballed oil and gas well, one of dozens scattered across this part of Louisiana. He splashed across a shallow bayou in a spray of muddy water and pounded through the woods at high speed, leaving a trail of broken branches and flattened undergrowth. On the run, he detached an American-made Stinger surface-to-air missile from one of his weapons packs. Berushev broke out into the clearing and swiveled around to face the oncoming helicopter. It was very close now.
no more than 100 meters away, and a little more than a couple of 100 meters above the forest canopy. A harsh buzz sounded in his headset. The Stinger's infrared seeker had lost